She'd know that I've seen her, and I don't want her to know that until I've spoken to my brother.
Your brother?
Too much talking, pretty thief. I have to rest now, but promise you won't tell her. He didn't need to describe her. It had to be Fausta he was talking about. I didn't even want to know what she'd been up to.
I'm not a thief, I said, and I won't say anything to her. I haven't seen you anyway, only your eyes.
Well, what do you think of my eyes, pretty thief?
They are an old man's eyes, I answered, and I held the Life of Galileo up in front of my face until I heard him walking away. He walked all the way to the back of the library and up some stairs. I hadn't known there was a staircase in the library until I heard him going up it. Look, Montserrat, and you'll see that there is one, built between two shelves, leading up to a door halfway up the wall. Through that door is the wing of the main house that only a few of the servants were familiar with, though we all knew that Isidoro Salazar, the master's younger brother, lived in that part of the house. Lived? Well, we knew the man was dying there and did not wish to be talked to or talked about. A special cook prepared his meals according to set nutritional principles of immortality that a Swiss doctor had told the master about, and Fausta had told us how she laid the table and served the meals in Isidora's rooms. He waited in the next room while she did it, and no matter what he ate or didn't eat, he was still dying. When I thought about that, I worried that my words might have added to Isidora's troubles. The next day, after Fausta had brought him his lunch, I wrote, I should not have been like that to you. Rude and thoughtless maid from the library. On a piece of paper, ran up to his rooms and pushed the note under his door. As I stayed away from the library for a while, only returning when the chatter of the books reached where I slept in the maid's dormitory on the other side of the house. He wasn't there that night. But when I went to my shelf of choice to take down Galileo, I saw a slip of paper sticking out of the neighboring book. The slip read, To the Pretty Thief. Read this book, and then look for more. I loved some of the books he chose. Others sent me to sleep. I turned his slips of paper over and wrote down my thoughts. One of the books he chose was a slim pamphlet of poetry that didn't make much sense to me. I dismissed it with a line borrowed from other poems he'd introduced me to. It may well rhyme, but it accordeth not. He responded with a really long and angry letter. I think he must have been the author of those poems I didn't think were good. Isidoro wouldn't come near me, even when I began to want him to. We'd spend nights reading together on separate sides of a shelf, not speaking, listening to the books around us. According to Stendhal, it takes about a year and a month to fall in love, all being well. Maybe we fell faster because all was not well with us. Every day it got harder for me to keep you to myself. And he could not forget that he was dying. He fought sleep until the nightmares came to take him by force. He fell asleep in the library one night. He had done this twice before, but out of respect for him I had left using a route that meant I could pass him without looking at him. But when I heard him saying, No, no, I went to him without thinking and leaned over him to try to see whether I should wake him. He was younger than the look in his eyes suggested. I don't know what his sickness was. It had some wasting effect. Even as I saw his face, I saw that its beauty was diminished. You can read character in a sleeping face, and his was quite a face. The face of a proud man, vengeful and not a little naive. A man with questions he hadn't finished asking and answers to some questions I had myself. He opened his old man eyes and took a long, deep breath as if breathing me in. It must have looked as if I was about to kiss him. Our faces were very close, and curtains of my hair surrounded us. If we kissed, it would be our secret to keep. I kissed him. Then I asked if it had hurt. He said he wasn't sure, and that we'd better try it again. And he kissed me back. I didn't want to leave him after that, but I had to be back in bed by the time the other maids began to wake up. Montserrat, I wrote that being in love with your father was nice, but being in love with Isidoro Salazar was like a dream. Not because of money or anything like that. The man loved foolishly and without regard for the time limit his learned doctors had told him he had. He made me feel that in some way we had always known each other and that he would be at my side forever. When Fausta Dell'Olmo took me aside and asked, "Is there anything you want to tell me?" My blood should have run cold, but it didn't. After all, she could have been asking about the pregnancy. Beyond Isidoro's staircase is a door that connects to a walled garden. The garden is Isidoro's, too. He planted all the roses there himself and took care of them until he got too sick to do anything but just be there with them of an evening. We were often there together. It's a long walk from the top of the garden to the bottom, and I'd carry him some of the way. Yes, on my back, if you can imagine that. He was drowsy because of his medication. He had to take more and more. But even through the haze of his remedies, he remembered you. The baby! I told him you didn't mind. You don't, do you? And that his weight was balancing me out. He grew more lucid when we lay down on the grass. He was so fond of the roses. One night I told him that he wouldn't die, but that he would become roses.
I wouldn't mind this dying so much if that were true, he said slowly. But wait a minute. Roses die too.
Well, after that, you'd become something else. Maybe a wasp, because then you could go around stinging people who don't like your poems. It was around that time that I kept finding gifts on my bed. Little gifts, but they got bigger and bigger. A mother-of-pearl comb, a calfskin purse, a green cashmere shawl. I told Isidoro to stop giving me gifts. The other servants were asking about them. Isidoro simply smiled at first, but when he asked me to show him the gifts, I saw that he was perplexed and that they hadn't come from him. "Are you sure there's nothing you want to tell me?" Fausta Dell'Olmo asked, and maybe it was just a beam of sunlight that struck her eye, but I thought she squinted at my stomach. She added that the master would return in 2 weeks' time. I didn't even answer her. Suddenly she pushed me. If I hadn't clutched the stair rail, I would have fallen, and as she passed me, she hissed, "Why should it be you who sees him?" That afternoon I found the last gift under my pillow. It was a diamond ring. I put the box in the pocket of my apron and kept it there until night time, when I went to the library. I showed the ring to Isidoro and asked him what I should do. He said I should marry him. He had instructed Fausta Dell'Olmo to put the ring beneath my pillow. He was sure that she had been responsible for the other gifts, even though they were nothing to do with him. She was planning something, but it didn't matter, or it wouldn't if I married him.
"Time is of the essence," Isidoro said.
All I could do was look at him with my mouth wide open. And then I said yes. He said I must fetch a priest at once, and I didn't know where to find a priest. So I went and woke Fausta Dell'Olmo up and asked her to help me. She gave me the oddest look and said, "What do you want a priest for?" "I'm marrying Isidoro Salazar tonight," I said.
"Oh, really? And I suppose he's the father of your child, too?"
she whispered, her eyes glinting the way they do when she gets hold of a secret at last.
"Please, just hurry."
Fausta Dell'Olmo put on her coat and slippers and ran out to fetch a priest, and the man of God arrived quickly. He was calm and had a kind face, and took my hand and asked me what the trouble was.
"But didn't you tell him, Fausta, that this is a wedding?"
Fausta shrugged and looked embarrassed, and I began to be frightened of her all over again. Something was wrong. I took the priest to the library, and Fausta Dell'Olmo followed us. Isidoro wasn't there. But when I opened the library door, a door at the far, far end of the room slammed shut. Isidoro had seen Fausta and escaped into the rose garden. I went after him, but Fausta and the priest didn't follow me. They were talking, and Fausta was pointing at something. I now realize it was the door to Isidoro's rooms that she was pointing at. Isidoro wasn't in the garden. After searching for him, I went back into the library, which was also empty. I could hear a lot of noise and commotion in the rest of the house, footsteps hurrying up and down the wing where Isidoro's rooms were. I saw his rooms, the inside of them, I mean, for the first time that night. The priest Isidoro and I had sent for was praying over a waxen body that lay in the bed. When the priest finished his prayers, he said that I must not be afraid to tell him the truth, that no one would punish me, that I'd done well to send for him. "What do you mean?" I said.
"This man has been dead for at least a day. No, don't shake your head at me, young lady. See how stiff he is? He'd been very ill, poor soul, so this is a release for him. You came here this morning and found him like this. Isn't that what happened? And your master is away, so you worried all day about who to tell and what you would say, until the worry made you cook up this story in your head about a wedding. Isn't that so?"
All the servants were listening, but I still said no, that he was wrong. I put my hand in my pocket to take out my ring and show it to him, but the ring was gone too. "My ring!" I said, turning to Fausto Dolomo, who replied in the deadliest, most gentle voice.
"What ring, Aurelia? Be careful what you say."
After that, I stopped talking. I looked at the body in the bed and told myself it was Isidoro and no one else. This was a truth that I had to learn. Things would go very badly for me if I refused to learn it. But the lesson was very hard indeed. The priest left, promising to write to the master as soon as he got home, and all we servants went to bed. Fausto was the last to leave Isidora's room, closing the door behind her as quietly as if he was just sleeping. Then she took my arm and dragged me downstairs to the maid's dormitory, where judge and jury were waiting. Was I mad, or was I simply a liar? They'd already taken out the little gifts I'd received and were talking about them. Now Fausto told them where the gifts had come from. I'd taken the key to the library from the master's laundry, she announced, and I'd been selling off a number of his valuable books. I inferred from this that this is what Fausta herself had been doing before I'd interrupted her with my library visits. "But how stupid to spend the money on things like this," the cook said, flapping the green shawl in my face.
"Some people just don't think of the future," Fausta Dolomo said.
A couple of the other maids hadn't joined in and looked as if they didn't entirely believe Fausta Dolomo. Perhaps they'd had their own problems with her. But then Fausta announced that even Isidora Salazar had known I was a thief. She showed them some of the slips of paper Isidoro had left for me in the library. Slips he must have left that time I stayed away. The words "pretty thief" persuaded them. The master is a generous man, and stealing from him causes all sorts of unnecessary difficulties. Now that some of his books are gone, he may well become much less generous. The servants drove me out of the dormitory. They went to the kitchen and took pots and pans and banged them together and cried, "Shame! Shame! Shame!" I stayed in my bed for as long as I could with my covers pulled over my head, but they were so loud. They surrounded my bed. Shame! 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 So loud I can still hear it. Shame! 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 I fled, and Fausta and the servants chased me through the corridors with their pots and pans and screeching. Someone hit me with a spatula, and then they all threw spoons, which sounds droll now that it's over, but having silver spoons thrown at you in a dark house is a terrifying thing. You see them flashing against the walls like little swords before they hit you. It would have been worse if those people had actually had knives. They completely lost their minds. I made it into the library by the skin of my teeth and locked the door behind me. I wrote, "Am writing this letter to you, my Montserrat. The servants have given up their rough music and have gone to bed. You will be born soon, maybe later today, maybe tomorrow. I feel you close. I know where I will have to leave you. As for this letter, I will give it to the roses, and then I must get out of here for a while. How long? Until I am sure of what happened, or at least the true order of it all. Did I somehow give him more time than he would have had on his own? The entire time I have been writing this letter, I've felt Isidora's eyes on me. He seems to be telling me that we would still have been married, that if I'd only brought the priest and not Fausta, we could still have been married. Of course, he cannot really be telling me anything. I have seen him as a dead man. Why am I not afraid?" Monza found that she'd walked the length of the library as she read her mother's letter. Now she stood at the door to Isidoro's garden, which opened with the same key. Outside, someone in the shadows took a couple of startled steps backward. Signora Lucy. I saw all this light coming out from under that door, Lucy said. That was new.
She peered over Montse's shoulder.
Swap you a rose for a book, she said.
Sorry doesn't sweeten her tea. To you who eat a lot of rice because you are lonely. To you who sleep a lot because you are bored. To you who cry a lot because you are sad. I write this down. Chew on your feelings that are cornered, like you would chew on rice. Anyway, life is something that you need to digest. Chun Yang He. Be good to Boudicca, and Boudicca will be good to you, Kedele Omer said.
Boudicca and I eyed each other through the blue-tinted glass of Ked's fish tank, and I said,
Tell me what she is again. To the naked eye, Boudicca is a haze of noxious green that lurks among fronds of seaweed, looking exactly like the aftermath of a chemical spill.
But Ked's got the certificate that states Boudicca's species is Betta splendens,
colloquially known as Siamese fighting fish, because fish of this kind have a way of instigating all-out brawls with their tank mates. It's almost admirable. Boudicca doesn't care how big or pretty her fellow fish are. If they come to her manor, she will obliterate them, whether that means waiting until the other fish is asleep before she launches her attack, or in the case of a fish that simply refused to engage with her, eating the eggs that the other fish had spawned and then dancing around in the water while the bereaved mother was slain by grief. So now Boudicca lives alone, which is exactly what she wanted all along.
I get this vibe that Ked, the eternal bachelor, sees Boudicca as a fish version of himself, but he's never said that out loud, at least not to me. We don't have those kinds of talks. Even if Ked and Boudicca are on some level the same person,
the fact remains that the man is able to feed himself and the fish needs someone to see to her nutrition a couple times a week.
Ked called me over to tell me he was going away for 2 years and he expected me to take care of Boudicca. Twice a week for 2 years. Plus, Ked's house is spooky.
A House of Locks, it's called. That's the actual address. House of Locks, Ipswich, Suffolk. He travels a lot and I have a spare set of keys for use while on best friend duty, watering his houseplants when he used to have houseplants, collecting posts, etc. But when I'm in there, I don't linger. Nothing has actually happened to me in there, not yet anyway. But every time I go into that bloody house, there's that risk of coming out crazy, because of the doors. They don't stay closed unless they're locked. Once you've done that, you hear sounds behind them, sounds that convince you you've locked someone in. But when you leave these doors unlocked, they swing halfway out of the door frame so that you can't see all the way into the next room, and it's just as if somebody's standing behind the door and holding it like that on purpose. The windows behave similarly. They won't fully open unless you push them up slowly, with more firm intent than actual pressure.
Only Ked really has the knack of it.
Apparently the house's first owner took a particular pleasure in fastening and releasing locks. The feel and the sound of the key turning until it finds the point at which the lock must yield. So for her, the house was a lifetime's worth of erotic titillation.
It's a nice house for Ked, too. In that it's big and he got it on the cheap, and anyway, he's not really comfortable in overly normal situations. As it is, he hears voices. Nobody else hears these voices, but they're not just in Ked's head, you know. In this world, there are voices without form. They sing and sing, as they have from the beginning and will continue until the end. Ked borrows their melodies. That's the music part of the songs he writes. For words, Ked uses rhymes from our village, the kind that nobody pays attention to anymore because they advocate living by a code that will surely make you one of life's losers.
A lot of stuff about living honestly and trying your best. Even if you only have one tiny job to do, do it well, do it well, do it well.
These songs of Ked's turned out to be a hit with a lot of people outside our country. Ked got internet famous and then magazine famous and all the other kinds of famous after that.
It was fun to see. His mother still says to me, But don't you think people overreact to our Kedele Omer? His girls screaming and fainting just because he looked at them or whatever. He's just some boy from buzzing.
That's the power of those two voices, man. And now that you know that Ked and I are from a small village, that might make you say, oh, okay, so that's why this guy believes in voices he's never heard. But trust, living in a small village in a country that's not even sure it's really a country, you see a lot of shit that's stranger than a shaman, which is what Ked is, or was, before he started making money from the voices.
Every day there was news that made you say, oh, really? Some new tax that only people with no money had to pay. Or yet another member of the county police force was found to have been an undercover gangster. If not that, then a gang member was found to have been an undercover police officer. An Ottoman-style restaurant opened in a town nearby. It served no food, but had a mineral water menu tens of pages long, and fashion models came to drink their way through it while we played football with their bodyguards. Speaking even more locally, there was this one boy at our school who had quite a common first name and decided to fight every other boy in our postal code area for the right to be the sole bearer of that name. Can you imagine?
I was one of the boys on his hit list, and I was already getting picked on because I didn't have a father.
But what a ridiculous place we were born into. That fatherlessness was a reason why people would flick a boy's forehead and say insulting things to him, then pile on four against one when he took offence.
It's not our fault we're ridiculous people, Ked and me. How could we be anything else? Ked was the absurd-looking boy who suddenly grew into his features and became really good-looking overnight. That didn't seem right, so we got picked on too. But Ked had been thinking.
And the result of that was his going around offering assistance to the other boys who had the same name as me, arguing that if our little problem fought us individually, he would easily beat us, but if we stood up to him together, none of us would have to change our name. The others feared duplicity more than anything else. This was why, since duplicity was all we knew, and decided it was better to take their chances as individuals.
I believed Ked, though.
With the solemnity of a couple exchanging vows, we slipped knuckle dusters onto each other's fingers, four for each hand. Then I walked over to the boy, who didn't think he should have to share his name with anybody, and without saying a word, I smacked the pot of chocolate pudding he was eating right out of his hand. He was so astounded he just stood there, pointing at me as his friends came loping over like bloodthirsty gazelles. I didn't even check whether this Kedaleoma boy really had my back, but I trusted that he did. And he did. What a great day. A day that a modest plan worked. That guy changed his name in the end.
And it's been like that ever since with Ked and me.
He was lucky enough to be a year older than me, and when he graduated from our school, it was like I was the only sane one left in an asylum. There was more and more bullshit every day.
But Ked waited for me at the school gates,
and he had a lot of good pep talks. That's why it's pretty odd that Kedaleoma went back for mandatory military service. Only passport holders have to do that, and I thought he'd given up his passport, like I had. No, I never told you that, Ked said. But why would you keep it? Haven't you seen the stuff they write about you over there? You've sold out, you're scum, blah, blah, blah. So what, now you're trying to change people's minds? Why those minds in particular? I thought we... Yeah, I know what you thought, Ked said. He laughed and ruffled my hair. All of his was gone. He'd just come back from the barber's. Baldness made him look younger than I'd ever seen him, and toothier too. Like a stray, but a dangerous stray. You could take him home if you wanted to, but he'd tear the walls down. It's time for me to be part of something impersonal, he said. Duty as big as it gets. Do these people like me? Do I like them? Am I one of them? All irrelevant. I'll be directing all of each day's effort toward one priority. Defend the perimeter. Other things my best friend said to me. That 2 years was but a short span. And in the meantime, he hoped his House of Locks would become a kind of sanctuary for me. It would have been a really nice speech if Boudicca hadn't been blinking balefully at me the whole time. You there, forgot to feed me once, just one time, and you're dead. I mumbled that I had a lot on at work, but I'd see what I could do. I don't tell Ked how often the things he says come true. That's for his own good, of course, so that he stays humble. But here's an example. This past couple of weeks, alone, I've come to the House of Lux 7 times. 4 times to feed Boudica and walk the length of a tank. The first time she raced me to the farthest corner, and all the other times she's turned her back. The rest of my visits have been for sanctuary, I suppose, just like Ked said. All I've seen or heard of him since his departure are blurry photographs of his arrival at barracks, these posted on various fan sites. He hasn't called a reply to emails, so I walk through the wing of the house that he favours, passing the windows with various views of his fountain. A girl of pewter stands knee-deep in the water, her hands cupped, collecting streams and letting them pour away. Her eyes are blissfully closed. In the room I'm watching her from, the curtains hang so still that breathing isn't quite enough to make me believe there's air in here. The front door is the only one I lock behind me, so as I go through the house, all the doors behind me are ajar. It's still hair-raising, but it's reassuring too. The house is wonderfully, blessedly empty. Nobody else will appear in the gap between the doors. That gap is a safe passage across all those thresholds I crossed without thinking. About work. I run a clinic for my Aunt Thomasina's company. A Swiss-style weight loss clinic, to quote the promotional materials. This basically means that people come here for 3 days of drug-induced and maintained deep sleep, during which they're fed vitamins through a drip. This is a job I jumped at when it was my non-KED-dependent ticket out of Bazin. It's not as peaceful as I expected. Most of the sleeping done here is the troubled kind. A lot of sleep-talking and plaintive bleating. None of the sleepers are okay. Not really. On the bright side, the results are visually impressive. Most clients drop a clothing size over those 72 hours. Aunt Thomasina experienced this herself, before she ever tried it out on anybody else. Something awful happened to her when she was young. She's never even hinted at what that might be, and she took what she thought was a lethal dose of valerian and went to bed, only to wake up gorgeously slender 3 days later. "This will be popular," she said to herself, and she was right. Most days the waiting room is full of clients happily shopping on their tablet devices. The whole new wardrobe they just ordered will be waiting for them at home after their beauty sleep. Of course, weight loss that drastic is unsustainable, which makes the clinic a great business model. We send our monthly customers Christmas and birthday cards. They're part of the family. We have doctors who make sure that we're not admitting anyone likely to suffer serious complications from our treatment. So my job is mainly monitoring and addressing complaints and unrealistic expectations. I can fake sympathy for days. Aunt Thomasina says I'm a psychopath and that it's a good thing I came under the right influences at a young age. I also do night shifts, since we can't lock anybody into their rooms and I'm good with sleepwalkers. Last week we had 2. One guy rose up, pulling tubes out of his skin because he's not used to sleeping indoors in summer. He grew up in an earthquake-prone region, and his family hit upon the strategy of sleeping in a nearby field so as to avoid having their house fall down on them. My shift partner got him back into bed with warm assurances of safety, but when it was my turn, I merely whispered, "You are interrupting the process, my friend. Do you want her to regret or not?" He sleep ran back down the corridor and had to be restrained from reattaching himself to the vitamin machine. That was what he'd written in his questionnaire beside objective. To be sexy, so that she regrets. Our other sleepwalker was just extremely hungry. You can't coax someone out of that. This client got up and searched for food with such determination that she had to have her drug dose significantly elevated. For a couple of hours it seemed her hunger was stronger than the drugs. I sat out the third intervention and stayed in the monitor room watching the camera feed. It was fascinating to watch her returning to the surface of sleep, crying, "Chips! Chips!" But eventually she went down hard and stayed under. Ultimately, she was happy with her results, but apart from the usual disorientation, she also looked really thoughtful, as if asking herself, "Worth it? She probably won't be back." The sleepwalkers upset my shift partner, Taiki. Her being upset helps her get through to them, I think. They can tell that she cares about them and isn't judging them like I am. Taiki is someone that I think Ked should meet. She's only a part-timer at the clinic. Her business card states that the rest of the time she does odd jobs, invocations. Invocations. Something she learned while trying to do something else, she says. So she can relate to Aunt Thomasina's weight loss discovery. Taiki's beauty is interestingly kinetic. It comes and goes and comes back again. Or maybe it's more that you observe it in the first second of seeing her, and then she makes you shelve that exquisite first impression for a while so she can get on with things. Then in some moment when she's not talking or when she suddenly turns her head, it hits you all over again. There's a 4-star constellation on her wrist that isn't always there either. When it is, its appearance goes through various degrees of permanence, from drawn on with coal to full tattoo. I mentioned this to her, but she laughed it off. "But don't you stare at me too much? Everything okay with your boyfriend?" In my matchmaking capacity, I've paid closer attention to her visuals than I would pay to anybody on my own behalf. On to her inner qualities. She's powerful. Not just in doing whatever she does to make people listen to her instead of watch her, but I think she heals herself. She wears a wedding ring, so I made reference to her partner, but she held up a hand and said, "Oh, this. I found it." Then she told me about it. A while ago, she'd been in a relationship with someone who was adamant about keeping her a secret, to the extent that they didn't acknowledge each other if there was even one other person in sight. Her superpower was picking emotionally unavailable partners, and she doubted she'd get a better offer. She also assumed that the relationship would gradually get less secret. Nothing changed, and while she continued to profess her commitment to her secret boyfriend, her body disagreed and tried to get her out of it. She got sick, her hair started falling out, and her skin went scaly. She was cold all the time and could only fall asleep by reciting words of summoning. Nobody came. But one evening, at the pub down the road from her house, she found a ring at the bottom of a pint of lager she was drinking. The ring was heavier than it looked, and she recognized it without remembering exactly where she'd seen it before. Since no one at the pub seemed to know anything about the ring, she took it to the police station, only to return there to collect it at the end of the month. There had been no inquiries related to the item, so it was hers, and when she wore it, she felt that a love existed. For her. Her. Of all people. And it was on all the time. Of this love, there would be no photographs, no handwritten declarations, no token at all save the ring. If this was the only way that what she'd called could come to her, then it sufficed. She was content. The hand that wore the ring grew smooth, and she recouped her losses. "Didn't some nuns used to wear wedding rings?" I asked her. She nodded and said that that was something she thought about a lot. I'd best introduce her to Ked before the nuns get her. Ked's voices are bullies. They won't let him play unless it's for keeps. Taiki might have an answer for them. But why am I treating Ked's celibacy as something to be fixed? Maybe because I'm so much in his debt for so many things, and I can't think of any other way to settle up. Maybe I've become evangelical ever since I got a little family of my own. The scene at the homestead is different every day. My boyfriend has joint custody of his 2 daughters with his ex-wife, whose schedule is ever-changing, so the girls might be home at night, or they might not. Dayang is the elder at 16. Aisha's 18 months behind her. Dai is studious and earnest, a worrier like her father. She carries a full first aid kit around in her school bag and tells me off for calling her boyfriend by a different name every time I see him. In my defense, the boy genuinely looks different every time he comes over, but dies concerned that he'll think she has other boyfriends. This would be catastrophic because Mr. Face-Shifting Boyfriend is the one. And how can she tell he's the one, I ask? Well, how did I know that her dad is my one, she asks. Some things are just completely obvious. Gosh! Di's great, but Aisha is my darling and my meddlesome girl. She's the one who gets the question, but why are you like this, at least once a day from her father? If she isn't growing something, she is the reason Noor finds toadstools in his shoes, or brewing something, she's the reason it's best not to leave any cup or drinking glass unattended when she's at home. She'll pass by singing and swishing her tail around. She put her sewing machine to work making a set of tails that she attaches to her dresses. A fox's tail, a dragon's tail, a tiger's tail, a peacock's. On a special occasion, she'll wear all of them at once. Last month, Matthias Fuscht released a new album and Aisha hosted a listening party for 5 bosom friends. The bosom friends wore all their tails, too. Those were the good old days, when Aisha's love for Matthias Fuscht was straightforward idol worship. Her wall was covered with posters of him. She sometimes got angry with him for being more attractive than she thought anyone was allowed to be, and would punch a poster right in the face before whispering frantic apologies and covering it with kisses. She had Noor or me buy certain items because she'd read an interview in which he mentioned he loved this or that particular scent or colour on a woman. All of Aisha's online IDs were some variation of her official motto. Matthias Fuscht is love. Matthias Fuscht is life. Ked had met Fuscht a few times and said he wouldn't want any daughter of his going anywhere near that dickhead. But the first time he said that, I took it with more than a pinch of salt. For starters, Aisha's polite refusal to have a crush on her friendly neighbourhood pop star was something of an ego bruiser. There were a few other small but influential factors. Fuscht's being 10 years younger than Ked, and it's being well known that Fuscht composes, arranges and writes the lyrics for all his, mostly successful, songs himself. No voices. It just wasn't really possible for Ked to like him. Fuscht was forever being photographed wearing dark grey turtlenecks, was engaged to be married to a soloist at the Bolshoi Ballet, didn't seem to go to nightclubs, and reportedly enjoyed art house film, the occasional dinner party, and the company of his cat, Kleinschak. A clean-shaven man with a vocal tone reminiscent of post-coital whispers, that was Matthias Fuscht. The way he sings, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star," is no joke. Ked had been away for about a month when I got home to find love to hatred turned. Noor was making dinner, checking his recipe board after each step, even though he knew it just as well as if he'd written it himself. The not-so-hidden charms of a man who takes his time over every detail, especially once you distract him for just long enough to turn all his attention on to you. It didn't occur to me to ask about the kids until halfway through our very late dinner. Bad stepfather. Have the kids already eaten? Noor shook his head. They promised they'd have something later. Why? Not sure. Heartbreak, I think. Ah, so the face shifter isn't the one after all. No, it's not Di. Well, it is Di, but only because she can't let Aisha go through it all on her own. The sisters were huddled together on Aisha's bed with a laptop between them. They closed the laptop when I came into the room, leaving me to look around at the bare walls and wonder what had happened. Both girls were red-eyed and strenuously denied being upset. When I left the room, I clearly heard Di say, "You've got to stop watching it." And Aisha answered, "I know, but I can't." Then she said, "Maybe it isn't true, Di. It probably isn't true." And Di said, "Oh, Aisha." Noor and I watched the video ourselves downstairs. It was called A Question About Matthias Fuscht. Noor found it hard to watch in one go. He kept pausing it. This cowardly pacing would normally have been grounds for a dispute. I agreed with him just that once, though. The video opened with a woman sitting on the floor in her underwear, showing us marks all over her body. A lot of the marks were needle track marks, but they were outnumbered by marks I hadn't wanted Di and Aisha to ever become acquainted with. Bruises left by fists and boots. I dreaded the end of the camera's journey up to the woman's face, and didn't know what to think when I saw that it was untouched, even a subdued kind of pretty. No makeup, clean, mousy-looking hair, age absolutely anywhere between 25 and 45. I'd seen girls who resembled her waitressing in seedy bars across the continent, removing customers' hands from their backsides without turning to see who the hand belonged to, their gestures as automatic and unemotional as swatting midges. She pulled a T-shirt on and looked at the camera for a little while before she started talking. You could tell from her eyes that she was out of her head on something, and probably couldn't have told you her own name if you'd asked her. Her English was far below fluency, but since she was in her happy place, she didn't bother struggling with pronunciation. Just said what she had to say and left us to figure it out. She wanted us to know that the entertainer, Matyash Fusht, had picked her up on a street corner a few hours after he'd played a sold-out concert in Greenwich. She'd spent the rest of the night with him, and he hadn't proved very entertaining at all. "Tell us a bit more about yourself," the person holding the camera said. A woman, I think, trying to sound gentle, but her voice was thick with anger. The woman on camera obediently stated that she was often on street corners trying to get money, and that she didn't often get lucky. The men she signalled to could usually tell just by looking at the backs of her hands that she'd gone too far into whatever she was doing. But Matyash Fusht didn't care about that. He'd had a fight with his controlling bitch of a girlfriend, and it had taken all he had not to hit the girlfriend. Taking your fists to a prima ballerina with an adoring host of family and friends would be a very messy and expensive blunder. So he went looking for someone nobody cared about. And he found me, the woman on screen said, and giggled. Noor pressed pause again and left the room, went upstairs and knocked on Aisha's bedroom door. "Come and eat," he said. And Aisha and Day said they'd come in a minute. Hours later, they still hadn't come downstairs. We'd watched the rest of the clip by then. The whole thing was only 3 minutes and 30 seconds long, but we kept trying to watch it through Aisha's and Day's eyes, this woman telling us that after they'd had sex, Fusht had insulted her so that she slapped him, and once he'd received the slap, he'd smiled. Her fingers plucked the corners of her mouth, until we could see just how he'd smiled, told her she'd started it, and proceeded to beat her until she couldn't stand up. She'd hit back, she said. Even from her place at his feet she'd hit back, but every time he hit harder. Then he stood over her, in all his wealth and fame and arrogance, and shrugged, when she said she wasn't going to keep quiet about this. Matyash Fusht had shrugged and asked her if she thought anybody was going to give a shit that someone like her had got hurt. A nameless junkie with seriously crazy English. "Look at you," he said, "and look at me." He threw a handful of money at her and told her it was better for her to keep her mouth shut and spend that or save it for a rainy day. Then he went back to his girlfriend. They must have made up because she'd seen photos of them having a romantic dinner in a restaurant, and hints had been dropped about their wedding plans. "I look him on Google." The woman on camera seemed proud of her diligence. Then she asked us her question about Matyash Fusht. Did anybody care that he'd hurt her, someone like her? She was just wondering. She laughed and gave us a perky little wave at the end. "Thank you. Nice day to you." Aisha came in cradling her laptop in her arms. Di followed, hands helplessly rising and falling. "It's not just the clips, it's the comments," she said, when she saw us. "Ah, yes, the comments." Noor couldn't make himself look, so Aisha and I read some of them aloud. There was a lot of LOL, cool allegations junkie, maybe it was all a dream, and LMAO, people will say anything to ruin a good man's reputation, stay strong, Matyash. If only that was the worst of it. Aisha's haggard face, as she read, "Oh, boo-hoo, what's this one complaining about? He paid her, didn't he? She hit him, didn't she? Admitted all this herself. Does she think you can hit someone and just walk away?" I read, "She should count herself lucky. Men probably treat broken-down old whores worse than that in her country. And she got to bang Matyash. Matyash Fusht can beat me up any time, baby. LOL." Then the apologists came out to play. "Even if this is true, is it a full story? We know that Matyash wouldn't just lash out like that, so we need to be asking what she did." Dai showed us a screenshot she'd saved. She'd posted a comment of her own. "Guys, are you being serious? I'm appalled and really scared by this and all the reactions I'm seeing. This isn't the world I want to live in." She'd received so many replies telling her to kill herself that she decided to delete her account. "I still don't think it's true," Aisha said. "He couldn't have done something like this." When Noor put on his solicitor voice to point out that the video had been up for half a day, had a view count of 500,000, and would have had Matyash Fust's team of lawyers swinging left and right if the content hadn't had any basis in fact, Aisha said through gritted teeth, "But he hasn't said anything at all." "He'll probably make a statement in the morning," Noor said. We were failing as the men in Dai and Aisha's life. We weren't doing what we were supposed to do. This came through very clearly in the way that Dai and Aisha were looking at us, or more not looking at us, really. The morning brought no statement from Fusht, and Noor sounded relieved and ashamed of his relief when he said, "Looks like she hasn't got any proof, and he's going to ignore or deny it." In the afternoon there were reports of an eyewitness to the beating coming forward, and about an hour after that, Fusht's legal team announced that he'd voluntarily made himself available to the police for questioning. At the clinic my concentration was poor, and I mixed up checkout forms so that departing clients got to read details of each other's low self-esteem and experience the outrage of not being unique. Tai Kishore and I were on the same shift again, and got authorization to offer free secondary sleep sessions all round so we wouldn't be sued. But like Aisha, Taiki was addicted to the YouTube clip. She spent her break time watching it over and over on her phone and ran the battery right down. "I found that one tough to watch," I told her. "Really?" she said. "But it's just someone talking about this time she got beaten up. No bullets or gore or bombs or anything. This is nothing compared to other things you can see on this site." "I don't know what to say. I can't explain it." "Well, I hope she sees the view count and accepts that as an answer to her question about whether people care. These numbers are up there with the numbers for footage of the world's most brilliant strikers scoring the decade's most brilliant goals. So it's not that we're indifferent. We care. Just in a really, really, really fucked up way." Matyash Fust's fiancé released a statement as we were leaving work. She was shocked and upset to hear the events described in the video, and would be paying the victim a visit to see if there was anything she could do for her. She had never seen a violent side to Matyash's character, but it was now undeniable that he'd been struggling with some issues and they'd be spending some time apart while he completed a course of anger management therapy. No jail time for Fusht. Just a fine and some therapy, Taiki predicted, even as she admired the photo of the prima ballerina, who was elfin and ethereal and all the rest of it. "Yeah, well, I beg to differ," I said. Taiki stuck her hand out. "Bet you £100. I suppose this is all a joke to you, but I know a girl who's pretty badly shaken up by all this." Taiki sighed. "She was a fan." "She's still trying to be one, I think, clinging to every possible delusion." Taiki's sigh deepened. Let me know if intervention's required. Okay, thanks. I had it in my mind to ask Taiki what she thought she might be able to do for a girl she'd never met, in a spirit of curiosity, not hostility, but had to hurry over to the House of Locks.
Terry, the man who maintained Boudicca's fish tank, was waiting for me to let him in. After Terry left, I stayed a few more hours, reading Matthias Fuchs updates aloud to Boudicca, who looked suitably incredulous.
YouTube woman was glad she'd had the chance to meet the woman she'd found herself taking a beating for and wouldn't be pressing charges. She'd hit Fuchs first. That was an excessive response to some words he'd said, and his response in turn had been excessive. All she asked was acknowledgement of that, a sincere apology. So Matthias Fuchs was preparing a sincere apology. Has she read any of the comments? That's what I wondered. Did the woman from the YouTube video understand that the public wasn't on her side? She made her requests with such placid mirth as if talking into a seashell or a shattered telephone. As if Matthias Fuchs fans weren't actively looking for her, probably in order to finish her off. Even those who'd begun to condemn Fuchs believed his apologies should be directed elsewhere. Those who claimed they wanted to feel concern for YouTube woman didn't like that she'd filmed her allegations while high. And yet she might not have been able to talk about it sober. Noor texted that he was considering taking Aisha's laptop away until the Fuchs case died down. She seemed to have spent the entire evening engaged in a long and rambling argument with her friends via six-way video call. She attacked Fuchs' reputation, defended it, then attacked again, berated the friends who'd gone off on him for their faithlessness, cursed the infinite stupidity of his unchanged fans, and threatened to put on a Fuchs mask and beat them up to see how they liked it. She'd skipped dinner again and was running a temperature. When was I coming home? Two firsts. Being reluctant to leave Ken's house, and being reluctant to enter my own. I said I'd been at the gym. Ked does have a home gymnasium, he works out a lot, his body being his backup plan in case he gets ugly again. But I don't know why I lied. Aisha will get over this. But what of her tales, and her plant-growing projects, and the remarkably potent gin she was perfecting? That gin was going to make us richer than an entire network of 1920s bootleggers, I said, to see if that wouldn't rouse her. She likes money. Now it seems she liked it because she could exchange it for Matthias Fuchs-related items. What worries Noor is that three of Aisha's graven images fell off their pedestals at once. Him, me, and Matthias Fuchs. The girls seemed to pity our weakness. Noor's brusque talk of judicial process and media treatment. My awkward, awkward silence. Is it really bad that the girls have found us out, though? I never projected strength. Not on purpose, anyway. What are you really worrying about, Noor? He shuffled papers into his briefcase, rearranged his pens, straightened his tie.
I think I've lost them.
Just like that. Overnight. Their mother says they're fine with her. I loosened the knot of his tie a little, just a little. It still looked neat, so he couldn't complain. Nah, I don't even know them as well as you do, and I can tell they're just thinking. A casual overview of all their main emotional attachments reveals that Noor and his ex have been better parents than they realize. While Dai and Aisha appreciate strength, lack of it isn't a deal-breaker in the matter of whether they respect a person or not. All was quiet on the Matthias Fuchs front for a few months. I kept an eye on that situation, among others, and read that the reporters who managed to get a soundbite out of Fuchs all got the same one. He was completing his anger management therapy and was still preparing his apology. The soundbite was paired with another obtained from YouTube woman. Looking forward to it. It was around that time Ked and I started talking again, not often, but enough. I'd be entering or leaving the House of Locks, the phone would ring, and it would be Ked. He described his current existence as a cycle of drills and chores, and was so tired he'd fall asleep mid-sentence. It was good to speak to him, not just because it was him, but because he didn't know the first thing about the incident that had rocked my household. When I gave him a brief outline, he said, "Oh, you know the apology Fuchs preparing is going to be a song, right? And that song is going to be an anthem of repentance. It's probably going to be called Dress Made of Needles." "Nice. I'll go down to the betting shop tomorrow." There was something else I wanted to talk about while I had him on the line. When I answered his phone calls, he needed half a second to adjust his greeting, and it sounded as if he was disappointed that I was the one who'd answered. Well, disappointed is too strong a word. It was more as if I wasn't his first preference, which was fine, except that I'm the only person who has keys to his house. His mum's been trying to get a set for years without success. "So what's going on? You met someone?" "Not sure," he said. "I think so." "And this person has keys?" After a lot more questioning, he eventually confessed that he hadn't given a set of keys to anybody else and had never actually met this woman in person, but was fairly sure that she had keys because she sometimes answered the phone when he called. When he said that, I adjusted my position so that I was able to watch all the open doors, and I said, "That's wonderful, Ked. I'm really happy for you." "Don't overreact," he said. "She's a nice voice at the moment, nothing more. Like one of the ones that sing, except that she just talks." "Did you ask her how she got in?"
"Of course."
"Well, what did she say?"
"She encouraged me to think of a better question."
I glared at Boudicca. No wonder she'd been filling out lately.
"Maybe she feeds your fish too."
"Ha ha, maybe. But while we're talking about this, could you do me a favour? I don't think she wants to be seen, so if you let yourself in and happen to notice that she's around, just leave immediately, okay?"
"Okay, Ked. No problem."
Just another day in the lives of two boys from Buzzing. Still, I checked every room in Ked's wing of the house before I left. His alarm system's in working order, and none of his valuables have moved. For now. Ked's phone girlfriend earned me the first direct smile I'd got from Aisha in weeks. "You stupid boys," she said, lovingly. A string of text messages appeared on her phone, and her smile vanished as if it had never been. "Brace yourself," Noor shouted from the next room. "It's Maciej Fuchs' apology." Di wasn't ready to leave her bubble bath. "Oh no, no apology for me, thank you." So Aisha grabbed a couple of foam stress balls, jumped onto Noor's lap and said, "Go." We watched and listened to Maciej Fuchs singing a song about a girl who walked the earth in a dress made of needles that she couldn't remove without maiming herself. People with good intentions kept trying to pull the needles out and give her something soft and warm to wear instead, but the needles pricked their fingers so much that they gave up. Then the girl met a bad man who drove the needles in deeper, not with a hammer, but with his hands, for the thrill of joining his own torture to hers. Luckily the bad man managed to bleed out before he could kill her. It turned out his bones were magnetic. I might have misunderstood that part of the song, but whatever it was about his bones, they drew the needles from her and into him. He died in the utmost agony. The end. I kept waiting for Fuchs to wink, but he didn't. My favourite thing about this song is the way it starts out all about her and ends up all about him, Noor said, as we refreshed the page and fat red love hearts accumulated in the comments beneath the video. Maciej understands. This is exactly how I'm feeling today. Thank you, Maciej. Think we can all agree he shouldn't have done it in the first place, but now he's done the decent thing. We forgive you. All I could say was, amazing. How did it go from Fuchs should apologize to the woman he beat up, to Fuchs should apologize to his fiancée, to Fuchs
should apologize to us.
Aisha spoke through the stress ball she'd stuffed into her mouth, removed it, and started again.
Maybe this is a piece of conceptual art, like something out of one of Matyesh's favorite films. Couldn't you two women be an artist who's worked out a concept that uses the